Now, our assembly subject today, China's challenge, which may be construed, I would suggest to you, to include the internal challenges that China faces, as well as the challenges that China presents to us. It is clearly germane to nearly every other international issue confronting us, confronting the United States. And the success with which we define our relationship with China and act within that relationship may very well define our future position in the world. China, we all recognize, I believe, is a rising power in almost all respects. But there are obvious inhibitions, internal and external, to the rate and eventual extent of that rise. Our eventual default relationship may not necessarily be conflictive. There are collaboration links that can be fostered. 20% of the freshman class at Princeton is Asian American this year. But it is vital for us, we influential citizens, we in this room, to know and to understand China and her ambitions. That's the task that our speaker today will undertake. Bert Keil, of the class of 1968, is a development economist specializing in East Asia with a focus on China. He is a non-resident fellow at the Atlantic Council of the United States. Previously, he was senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where he covered China economic issues and related U.S. policy. Earlier, he served in the U.S. Treasury as acting director and deputy director of the Office of East Asian Nations, and before that, as Treasury's China desk officer. You notice that this is an incredibly ambitious curriculum in early years. As a senior economist in the World Bank, resident in Beijing, he covered China economic trends for 3 years. He has also worked in China and Korea and taught at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, where he had been hired by our classmate, George Packard, who is with us today. He also taught and still does at Georgetown University and George Washington University. In recent years, he has traveled to China to study how well China survived the worldwide economic financial crisis and has been engaged in Chinese internet study, a fascinating topic. Now, supported by U.S. government grants, he has expanded his scope of activity. He has recently studied the strengthening relations between China and Brazil, which have significant implications for U.S. relations with Brazil and the rest of Latin America. Also, he has been a frequent panelist on Voice of America programming aimed at China in Chinese. And apparently it is one of the interesting elements of that program that he answers questions from Chinese citizens in Chinese during the course of that programming. It is an enormous pleasure then to introduce Bert Keil.
Well, thank you very much, Rick, and I'm honored to be here, and I look forward very much to your questions and disagreements so that I can improve my understanding of what's going on in China and in its relations to the United States. I really look forward to this interaction. So I'll try to be brief because the conversation at the luncheon table showed that the questions are pretty piercing and revealing of limits of what I can explain satisfactorily, so I will try to provide more time for the end of my formal remarks. The gist of what I'm going to say today is that there are really two major data points in recent history over the last 10 years. One is the global financial crisis, which has really put to its knees the major economies of the world. The U.S. grew to less than 2.5% last year, and that growth didn't really spread to much of the United States. Europe is on its knees. Japan is doing very poorly in terms of growth terms, although at a very high level in terms of per capita GDP. So the world's economy kind of fell apart in the last 10 years and hasn't recovered, and the news from Greece makes that even more clear right now that the Greeks are fed up with the austerity solution of what our traditional mainstream ideas about what to do in the time of crisis. The second data point is that China has sailed through this difficulty very easily, showing an ability to stimulate its economy, to spread that economy to large members of its more impoverished population. And it did this using methods that it had used and has still used over 35 years since the death of Mao to develop an economy from an incredibly low level of poverty and underdevelopment to today, where it's now rivals the United States in total economic capabilities, although on a per capita basis it's still close to the 100th in the world. It's a very, so you have to say, it's still a very poor country on average terms. You have to look past the few billionaires that are buying up property in Hong Kong. So I'm going to say that this combination of events poses some real challenges to us and to the United States. To the United States, how are we going to manage our relations and our presence in East Asia and in the Western Pacific in the face of a China that's clearly succeeding? This is not a flash in the pan. China is going to continue to grow. It's going to continue to modernize its economy, become more sophisticated in virtually every dimension. So how do we deal with this economy that will be many multiples as large as we are, as wealthy as we are? One way to think about it is, will the headquarters of the World Bank in 50 years be in Beijing? Because it will have all the money that will be used to try to develop global infrastructure. That's an open question. It also challenges the United States to say, what do we have to do to ourselves? Are we in a perfect institutional position to develop our economy and to continue to grow rapidly and to solve our poverty problems and the problems of those left behind? Or do we also need to perhaps look at some of the things that worked in China and revise our understanding of what makes an effective political and economic system function at its optimal level? So that's one major challenge, China's challenge, is to the United States. A second is to the field of economics, which has vacillated back and forth between a pure market theory that says just let the markets handle the problems and they'll solve them for you, and the other spectrum that says no, you need an active government participation. This is in the tradition of Maynard Keynes, that said you need a counter-cyclical process. If the economy is going to go up and down, you can't just let it go up and down. If it goes up, you've got to try to keep it down. If it goes down, you've got to try to pull it up. And economics hasn't, in the last 50 years, it's moved further and further away from that active participation of government, of a democratic government, in the proper management of its economic affairs. And how do we, that's a challenge, because China's showing us that government can have a very effective role in pulling large portions of its population out of poverty as it grows very fast. And third, I'm going to focus on the challenge to other poor countries in the world and to the institutions that try to help them, the World Bank, the IMF, the Asian Development Bank. Are their methods correct, and do their charters allow them, for example, to address the inadequacies of actions on the part of the elites in those countries? Or are the proclivities of those elites the major problem? And in that case, because the World Bank and the IMF and other international financial institutions, they're not really allowed to talk about politics. And you have an enormous defensiveness on the part of countries from Indonesia to India to Brazil about why they're not doing very well when China's doing so well. And they brush it off as, well, China's a dictatorship, you know, so they don't count. If you look at what China has done, they've made choices that these other countries aren't making about the role of a democratic government could take, and I'll mention what those might be. And I think Rick mentioned one that I hadn't put in here, which is the challenge to China itself. And I think that's a very important. China has to be careful not to make mistakes that Korea made. It opened up its financial flows and capital accounts too early. It needs to be careful not to liberalize its financial system too fast, which was our mistake. We liberalized the beginning in the 1970s, and we allowed the role of so-called market forces to be too powerful in the financial industry, and it shot off the tracks by the 2000s. So China needs to be careful to not to follow those very attractive, almost seductive examples of more freedom for these institutions, because some freedom has already served us very well. You need to know where the degree is of proper balance between a constructive role of government and the great power, productive power of a market where profit and personal incentives have such strong play. So that's going to be it. Two data points and the challenges that they represent to a number of us. Now, my dear neighbors, Bud Cromwell and Elizabeth Wells, reminded me that I start talking about this stuff. They don't know the background. What is China? How did it get here? So let me just say a few quick things, because these also came out at the lunch. China's been an imperial power for maybe 4,000 or 5,000 years. It has had a dynastic cycle in which you have a flourishing empire that then declines in corruption, breaks apart, and then is unified by a nasty militaristic little band of warriors, and they survive for 20 or 30 years, and then they die, and then you have a new flourishing. That unification and the leveling of the playing field and the wealth field is the foundation for rapid growth, for welfare that spreads in terms of philosophical, in terms of technologies. China has seen that in every dynasty, and then it declines again, corrupts, falls apart, warlords, corruption, and then another nasty dynasty comes on. China has just finished that process again. The Qing dynasty that began in the 1600s was very strong, and of course, but it was pre-modern. By the 18th century, 19th century, it was beginning to crumble. There were rebellions that broke out in the early 19th century, and then the country basically fell apart by the end of the 19th century. And the Qing dynasty was over in 1911. There were numerous warlords that controlled different parts of it. The Kuomintang under Chiang Kai-shek was one lord. The communists were another warlord. There were individual warlords in different parts of the country that built their own railroads with their own gauges, had their own currencies. It was completely broken up. And then with World War II, the invasion of the Japanese, the Chinese communists did a better job of finding support from the population, and they unified the country. They had a better military strategy. They had less corruption. And so then you had a little nasty regime for about 30 years under Mao Zedong. And Mao died in 1976. And then you had reforms that have opened up in the late 70s and early 80s that introduced market forces, introduced international commerce, introduced a range of economic freedoms, particularly to farmers. And we're now seeing 30 years on plus, the continued evolution of that process in an early sort of dynastic unification of practical focus on what will work for our country to make it a power again, what that will make it able to provide the basic standards of living to its population. And I have the number of steps that they went through in the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s, and then they hit the financial crisis. And the financial crisis was brought on in China's case by this enormous expansion of U.S. credit, which was fueled by deregulation, enormous leverages that were allowed to our financial houses to just create money. Dollar-denominated money just grew in enormous volumes, and not because we had a budget deficit, not because the Federal Reserve System was irresponsible in that sense, but because on the same base of money, you could multiply it many times because you could lend it out, get it back into your bank, lend it out again on a very thin sliver of actual reserves. And that exploded into the world in purchasing power. A lot of it went into our real estate, but a lot of it went into imports that the U.S. bought. Print money, buy imports, you have a trade deficit. And those trade deficits weren't necessarily caused by unfairness, say, on China's part or other. Currency issue, the exchange rate issue is important. It occurred because the United States printed so much money through its financial leveraging that China was awash in these dollars coming in, and it created a lot of inflation in China in 2006, 2007. Finally, the Chinese had to contract their economy in 2007, and they were in very tight framework financially. Growth had slowed a lot in early 2008 as they led up to the Olympics. And then Lehman Brothers collapsed and hit them with a second whammy, which hit their trade. And trade had always been a secondary force in China. China is not like Japan. It's not export-led. It uses trade to buy technology. But when trade actually collapsed around the world, that added to China's woes. And what they did was they used the same instruments that they had developed to grow their economy in previous decades. They began what's called a counter-cyclical investment surge in infrastructure and in education and in public housing that employed a lot of people. It created a large number of jobs, and their growth continued at 6% for the worst that they dropped to, and then back up. Then they overdid it, and they overheated, and got back up to 10, 11, 12% growth. And then they had to slow that down, and now they're back to between 7 and 8% growth with almost no inflation. So you really have a miracle performance on the part of the Chinese in the face of what they would call the invasions. They said, we've been invaded by the United States with their money. Their money has invaded us. It invaded us before the crisis, caused this inflation. And then their solution, the United States' solution, was quantitative easing. And they had more money washing us. We've had to deal with that problem. The Chinese used to have to worry about money trying to leak out. But after the crisis, they had to worry about stopping money from coming in because it was messing up their economy. So the major issue in my remarks today is, how did they do that? What were these methods that they could use that allowed them to have this counter-cyclical, that when their economy went up, they could clamp it down to try to control inflation? More importantly, when it slumped, when there was no more demand or demand was inadequate, how did they boost demand that created jobs? The United States has this famous problem of pushing on a string. If you just push more money into the economy but nobody wants it, it doesn't create jobs. The answer has traditionally been then it needs to be spent by government. Government needs to spend money where jobs are created and where infrastructure is created and where you get the building up of some sort of competence on the part of the private sector that this is going to continue and that therefore they can invest also and that that can create new jobs. So that would be a counter-cyclical process in our economy, but we don't. We have an austerity program, as the Europeans do, which is just the wrong thing to do because we think that deficits are a problem. And we then have the Fed pushing money into the economy, thinking that companies now, if interest rates are low, they'll borrow and invest. But companies are saying, well, where's my market going forward? I'm not going to invest if there's no market. In fact, I need to prepare my balance sheets. And the stimulus that we have was heavily also tax deductions. Well, people that are underwater with their housing, they're not going to go out and take a tax break and spend it on a new car. They're going to try to improve their own bank account situation. So the design of the stimulus where you think that demand isn't the problem and you don't want to use deficit spending to solve it, you're stuck. And that's where we've been. And we're gradually starting to see growth for part of our population, but not for all. And the Europeans are still flat on their backs. So the Chinese have a series or a number of ways in which they have accomplished both their long-term growth and their response to the financial crisis. And the first one is this counter-cyclical financing ability. And because they have a better control and regulatory control over their financial system, the second component of this is they have an infrastructure bank. This is a government-owned bank. Actually, I don't know if you know, but North Dakota now has an infrastructure bank where you can borrow money. You take deposits, but you also can borrow money from other banks and invest it in infrastructure projects. In the United States, our financial system invests in infrastructure not by investing in state bonds, because that's very difficult to do. States are not really allowed to issue bonds in the United States unless they have a special bond issue on a ballot. But by creating non-budgetary entities. And the New Jersey and New York Port Authority is a good example. It's not on the New York or New Jersey budget. It's a separate entity, but it can borrow from the financial sector, improve the port. It has revenues with which it can service its obligations. The Chinese have done that all over the country. But instead of just relying on the financial sector to think that this is a good deal, their investment bank, their development bank, or an infrastructure bank, takes the lead. And when the economy slumps, pushes a lot of money into these infrastructure projects that create jobs, and that encourages the financial sector generally to invest in these infrastructure projects. And then when it gets overheated, the infrastructure bank pulls out a bit, and the other investors say, let's slow down a bit, and you get a slowing down, so that you have a catalytic component in government spending that gears or levers the investment spending of the rest of the economy. And that then has allowed them to have a counter-cyclical policy, that if they think things are overheated, they slow it down. And they don't just do it with interest rates. And if they think things need to be juiced up, they juice it up with the government investment that encourages others, that lowering interest rates doesn't necessarily do the trick. So in order to do that, the third thing that they have is a non-independent central bank. If the government says we need to lend to this infrastructure bank. You don't want a central bank getting in the way of saying, oh, we think that's inflationary and our major concern is inflation. You want to say, no, that's incorrect. Central bank, lend it to them. And the central bank in the hierarchy of Chinese ministries is about number 35. It's just not a very powerful agency, but it's a good barbarian handler because most of their staff speak English and they speak the lingo of markets and financial freedom, so that they maintain a friendly relationship. But the way the country is working is to use the central bank as what's called an accommodative agent. It accommodates the necessary investment that is countercyclical. The fourth is that they invest in public goods of all kinds. These are things the markets won't invest in because they don't make a profit. And whether it's public education or whether it's transportation, sanitary, whether it's infrastructure for the urban areas, mass transit, they're spending heavily on things that markets won't invest in, but which once they're generated, encourage investment in all kinds of facilities, both urban and non-urban. So that if you have, it's as if you're not just greasing the wheels, you're building the wheels of an economic system that then supports the private sector. They have then introduced in a huge way, particularly since the late 1990s, profit incentives and personal income incentives. So that you now have by far the largest employment sector in China is the private sector. The state enterprises have shrunk dramatically in terms of their presence in the economy. They did this with banking reforms in the late 1990s. They had a huge layoff of workers in the late 1990s out of the state enterprise system who had to go out and sell apples. But many of them then gradually found jobs because the urban population in China had been heavily subsidized. It was a Potemkin economy that the Chinese used to show off how modern they were. Meanwhile, there was a deeply impoverished rural economy that was feeding them raw materials that were extracted quantitatively by force and by prices that were very uneven. So when they introduced the rural reforms, you had an enormous reaction on the part of the cities against the freedoms and the prices that the cities were having to pay. And I happened to be at Tiananmen in 1989. I was writing a report for the Ministry of Agriculture, and these students started showing up, and I went and talked to them. And I said, you know, you guys are heavily subsidized. The peasants are 80% of the population. If you have democracy, they're going to vote away your subsidies. And you had a sort of a reflexive reaction on the part of students and workers, because the Tiananmen demonstrations were heavily workers. And they said, oh yeah, but they're peasants. They don't need to participate in the democracy. They don't need to vote. It's us. Look what's happening to us. So it was really a reaction against the impact of market reforms that were benefiting suddenly freed up farmers who had been given their own land, who were then making shoes themselves instead of buying state-owned enterprises. That was what was behind a lot of the violence at Tiananmen. And, you know, nobody was killed in the square. The violence occurred because workers began throwing Molotov cocktails at troop carriers as they came in, and the Chinese army shot back. It's a very complex, I've put into the book that I'm writing a lot of cables from the U.S. Embassy released in that summer saying to correct the picture, no students died in Tiananmen. Their exit was negotiated with the army and so forth. But the important point for me is that managing, and this is one of my points here, managing social unrest, anticipating it, it's unavoidable, but managing it by both focusing on what the problems are and trying not to let it get out of hand is a critical requirement for successfully developing a very poor country the way China has done. Some of the other points, China did not open its capital account. It didn't allow free financial flows in and out of the country because they're highly destabilizing. If you allow free financial flows in and out, you want to have a sort of a stable exchange rate, you have to let your interest rates match interest rates in the rest of the world, or else money will flow in and money will flow out. And it's the Asian financial crisis of 1997 is now pretty widely acknowledged was because Thailand and South Korea opened up their financial flows too soon. And it worked well for a while, and then they flowed out, and they were on their knees. And so an important dimension of economic development is not to open your capital account that soon or that fast, but to manage it. It doesn't mean you close it, but you manage it. You also have a structure of trade in which the Chinese say, you know, we really need to invest heavily. We need machinery, we need equipment, we need technology. So they manage their trade so that they don't import a whole wash of consumer goods the way the Russians have done, or the way a lot of Latin America does. They imported machinery and equipment, technology, and sort of discouraged the import of consumer goods, you know, by China. There's an economic theoretical tradition that says that's a very smart thing. The United States did that in the 19th century. There's a fellow named Friedrich List, writer, German-American economist from the early 20s. The British didn't want him anywhere around because he pointed out that Adam Smith is right, that if you have a certain productive capacity, it gets distributed efficiently if you allow free market and free exchange. But that doesn't do anything for increasing your productivity. It doesn't do anything for enhancing your productive forces. And Adam Smith says nothing about that. Instead, you need to invest. You need to provide market opportunities for your own domestic industries. And so that this, Japan and the Meiji Japan, they loved Friedrich List. And the Chinese in the 1980s, I took economics groups there, and these would be serious economists, and they'd sit down and they'd look across the table at the Chinese and say, okay, so who do you like? What economists do you follow? And they're hoping they'll say, well, we follow you. They didn't. They all said, well, we like Friedrich List. And the American economists sort of look at each other, who? Because he's not the free market opener that they expected. But that has been an important part, and it leads to another point, that the way to raise that productive power is through investment. And if you just start investing a lot of money into productive capacity, but you don't do anything to limit the growth of consumption, you're going to have inflation. So you need to slow down the growth of consumption in what is called savings. You need to increase your national savings so that you can have a relatively inflation-free growth experience with an increase in capital stock. That's what really raises the productivity of labor force, is to let it work with machinery more, to let it work in better buildings, and to be better connected through transport and communication. So savings, and the Chinese now, the savings rate is extremely high. And I go to Brazil, and their saving rate's under 20%. And they say, yeah, this is a real problem. And then they end up spending a lot of government money on subsidies for consumption. It's called the Bolsa Família, the family basket. But it's just money going to households in Brazil to be able to buy consumer goods. They need to grow the productivity of the labor force in Brazil, but they're not doing it. So, in summary, you have a really intelligent use of the role of government in developing an economy that can promote productivity, distribute it, and particularly the productivity dimensions to the lower income level so they can earn an income rather than just be handed some consumption. And that has been an explicit goal in the Chinese poverty program. We're not just going to give money, we're going to make people productive. It's called a Shengchang Li, or Shengchang Liu, Pingkun, Jihua. All right, so now the challenges I've already mentioned to U.S. national security. What do we do about a China that's going to be this powerful? It's going to grow. It's going to be successful. It's going to trade. It's going to have better and better technology. Now they just assemble the iPod. We make more value added of the iPhone in the United States than they do. And yet it all seems like it looks like it comes from China. But what are we going to do when China gets that big? One possibility is what's now in the Pentagon, or was until very recently, called the air-sea battle. And the air-sea battle is a contingency plan to use non-nuclear forces to preemptively take out Chinese capabilities that maybe in the next 10 years. Just launch massive attacks and be able to stop whatever they have. And we can do, we're so overwhelmingly more powerful militarily than the Chinese. But then the question is, where will that leave us in 50 or 100 years? If we messed up the Middle East 100 years ago with the Sykes-Picot Treaty and with the occupation of what had been the Ottoman Empire, and we're now facing a Middle East full of rancor and tension, what will the Western Pacific look like if we invoke the air-sea battle plan? So I don't think the forces that are responsible in our government are, I think of that at all, but it is a contingency plan in the Pentagon. And what will the Western Pacific be like? I was mentioning I just finished a work on a team doing a report for the U.S. government on what the Asian economies would be like, and my colleagues were all military or demographers or international relations persons, and this was the contract was really to say, well, you tell us what Asia is going to be like so we can be ready for it. And one of our report's major conclusions is the single most important factor behind what the Western Pacific and Asia will look like in the distant future, 20, 30 years, is what the United States does in that region. How do we shape and influence the evolution of that society and that group of economies. So that's the international challenge. The other challenge is to the United States. We're we're not doing very well. Our income distribution is deteriorating. We have not been able to introduce countercyclical methods because the reigning economic truths in our political sphere and in the public is that the government is just like a family sitting around its kitchen table. It needs to balance its budget. And, of course, that turns on its head the wisdom from the 1930s. And really, you have to say World War II. And from the Clinton administration, because if you have a rapid growth, tax revenues grow more rapidly than GDP. If you have a slump, tax revenues dive more quickly. So the answer is not in a slump to tighten up your budget. The answer is to have a budget deficit, get yourself out of it so the economy can grow, and then you pay off the debt, because then your revenues will grow more rapidly. But we've fallen out of that knowledge, and the proof of that is really that in 1939, U.S. debt was 40% of GDP. In 1945, U.S. debt was 120% of GDP. And that's 120% of 1945 GDP, which was much bigger. So enormous deficit spending got us out of the Great Depression. And yet that information is not computable now because it puts too much power in the hands of government, according to those that don't want. I mean, if you say, I like to say, less government means more bandits in a lot of third world countries. You have a weak government, you're going to have organized crime running your country. But that also holds for the United States. If we have less good democratic government, we're going to have forces that, for their own benefit, undermine the stability of our economy. And that's exactly what happened in the financial crisis over a period of 30 years, as we deregulated at the insistence of the financial industry. And then the incentives to make money were all there. You know, it came out of the woodwork, and people figured out all the subprime lending and no signature loans, just amazing things that were all in the scope of free markets, self-correcting markets. And yet we've known that leads to chaos. But right now the political grip in our country is that this is the best approach. And so we need to figure out, how do we introduce the kind of counter-cyclical economic forces that China has been able to utilize? And how do we finance the productivity of the lower ends of our income spectrum in the country? How do we make them more productive? How do we make them more able to work in jobs that require scientific machinery, scientific judgment? Those are enormous responsibilities that require some political will, but it requires an awareness that we have this problem. Right now, we don't see it as a problem that we have. We think we just need to let it go and we'll find our way out of it. And so that the United States then needs to find that it's not just full employment, which is one of the Fed's two goals. One is low inflation, the other is full employment. We need to grow. We need to grow faster. If we think that 4% growth is good, that's not going to pull our income distribution past our own poverty lines. We need to find a way to save more and invest more, and particularly in infrastructure and in education and the other things that raise the productivity of our whole labor force. This is what China has done, and that's the challenge, I would say, to the United States. Now, it's pretty clear that I think this is a challenge, the second challenge to economics as a science, that we would first acknowledge, and this is the one that clearly is going to be controversial when the book comes out. Economics needs to acknowledge that if you have a market economy, a standard part of a market economy and its performance is that some people will do better than others. And that's because they worked harder, and they took greater risks, or they cheated. One, it doesn't matter, but you're going to get a combination of people that do better in a market economy. Another natural thing is they will then use their success to influence the rules of the game. That's part of an economy. I mentioned that to Janet Yellen, and she was my professor at Harvard. And I said, you know, Janet, this is sort of a systemic issue. She said, oh, that's politics. You can't treat it as politics. We've got to see it as part of a market economy. That if you succeed in a market economy, you will naturally. It's not the conspiracy or anything. It's the incentives that drive you to do it. You will try to change the rules in your favor. And if you can develop institutions that limit that or keep that from happening, then you will thrive as an economy. But if you don't have institutions that prevent that from happening adequately, you will spot the Chinese, as I think I mentioned to this group the last time I was here, I worried to some Chinese out loud about, you know, we have some real problems. And he said, don't worry, you're just in your first dynasty. And he said, but you're in the second half of your first dynasty when it crumbles in corruption. So I think I've spoken on for too long. The other challenge that I mentioned at the outset is to poor countries. How do we get the elites in these poor countries to apply some of the tools that the Chinese have applied? particularly when it comes to educating and enabling the rise in productivity of their poorest groups so that they can earn higher incomes. The World Bank is forbidden from criticizing the politics of any of its members. And so you get these opaque, you even get the World Bank run report that said, well, but Brazil, you know, the Brazilians seem happy. It was an economic report. Instead of mentioning the really serious failures of the Brazilian government to invest at an adequate level in the things that will give it rapid growth. Right, I think in the interest of time, I'll cut it off there, but I look forward to your questions and hope you can have some tough ones for me. I'm sure you have many.
Bert, that was wonderful. I don't think I've ever heard a more succinct and brilliant exposition of all the complicated questions about China. Rick has asked me just to say a word or two about Japan, and I don't really want to do that. I think we got a topic and we don't need another one. But my question, I guess, is if we're going to maintain our position in the Asia-Pacific area, Japan is the centerpiece of that position. The friendship, the shared values, the legalistic system, the respect for the law and human rights and so forth. If we want our system to prevail, we've got to find other allies who agree with us. And so one of the dangers I see we're facing right now is taking Japan for granted. The media writes it off as a basket case. Believe me, it is not. If anyone wants to look at infrastructure, we are the basket case, you know, with our trains. Neil and I were talking about maglev trains in China and so forth. Our trains are terrible. Some of you may have come. Anyway, so that's how do we project power when we're crumbling at home and nobody is willing to spend the money? Secondly, I worry about Okinawa. It is a ticking time bomb. The Marine Corps footprint in Okinawa on those poor million people on an island about a third of Long Island, 20,000 Marines, all many of them 18 years old with raging hormones, with Ospreys and other kinds of Marine jets flying over, closing down schools, causing rape and causing crime. The Okinawans have had enough, and they're telling us that. And in election after election, they elect people who say, get the Marines out. Spread them around Japan. Don't put them all here. So, and there's no rationale, in my view, Burke might have a different view, for having that many Marines, especially when the Chinese have missiles that can take them out in about the first 5 minutes of combat. So I'd love to get your view on that, Burke. The third issue I'm worrying about a lot is the Japanese government today. Abe, the prime minister, is an unreconstructed nationalist who would like to take Japan back to the pre-war era, who is denying, if you see the paper today, he's denying the fact that comfort women, i.e. sex slaves, ever existed. And he has a strong following, not a majority, but a fair number of people. And I think it's up to the U.S. as an ally and a friend and a great power to take Mr. Abe to the woodshed at some point and say, that won't do. I think privately we may have done that, but publicly I think we should do that. And then I'd like to get your view, Bert, about TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and its chances for success. I read, in fact, there's a column this morning in the paper about that by David Ignatius, which says, if we pass TPP, and it would only pass if the Republicans in the Senate join with President Obama, and they appear likely to do so. If we pass that bill and get TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership, in place, it will increase U.S. exports by $123 billion per year by 2025 and create 600,000 new jobs. It's a no-brainer. We got to do it. I'd like to know what you think, both politically and economically, the chances are on that. And my final point is this, and I'd like your comment again. There is a Princeton professor named Aaron Friedberg. Many of you may have heard of him, have read his stuff. And Aaron, who worked on Dick Cheney's staff in the White House, has written a book whose title is A Contest for Supremacy, China, America, and the Struggle for Mastery in Asia. Okay? Now, and by the way, Mr. Friedberg has not, he may have been to China, he doesn't speak the language, doesn't know the culture, doesn't know the kind of history that you refer to. Where in the Bible is it written that we must struggle for mastery in Asia? You know, there can be accommodation. There can be, we can deal with those rocks, the Senkaku Islands, or the Diaoyutai, as the Chinese call it. We can deal with all that, but not if we go at it assuming that there must be, according to the iron laws of political science, a war in which a rising power must take on the status quo power. So I am skeptical of Mr. Friedberg's thesis, but I'd like to know, Bert, what your view is. So thank you for allowing me to rant a little bit.
Well, thank you very much. I think a comment you made at the end answers your first question in my mind, that if we are to have success in East Asia and the Western Pacific, Japan needs to be at the center of it. And you mentioned if we want our system or our values. My query is, isn't our own system also evolving? Don't we also need to understand better what freedom really means? Who has freedom? And what kinds of freedoms and how are they shared or shaved? And the Chinese are very early on in their ability to deliver those kinds of freedoms that we think are important. And in the meantime, they're delivering different freedoms. They would focus also a bit on economic freedoms, on certain rights. And the Japanese, if you remember, had a lot of similarities in their economic policies to what the Chinese have done. They didn't have an open capital account. I remember I bought a motorcycle in Japan in 1966, and I tried to sell it and convert the currency again back into dollar. I couldn't do it. You know, I'm sorry, we don't do that here. Go spend the yen somewhere. They had a focused government agency on long-term investment and on infrastructure. They had mechanisms for making sure that the corporate system also was in line with what were their investment priorities. These, some of them were informal. They had to do also with the fact that bureaucrats could retire and go into the corporate structure. But there was a clear, comprehensive program of a sometimes a murky form on part of Japanese that helped them grow rapidly. And of course, all their major task was to recover from what was already a highly industrialized country before World War II. Japan became an industrialized country during World War I. And so I would like to think that the three countries, as their economic status, particularly as the Chinese economic status rises, will learn and borrow from each other. And therefore, there should be no sense that we have to compete for supremacy in that continent. In fact, if we go that way, we will lose, unless we become bogged down in a land war somewhere in China. The approach we need to have is to say our values are evolving. They can be improved. Our values are not Adam Smithian, quack Adam Smithian ideas that if you just look out for yourself, you're doing the best for all society. Our values come from historic Judaic, Christian, and Islamic values from the book and from values that are shared with other religions in the world, that to an important degree you do look out for your family and your own welfare, but you also pay important attention to others and how your actions affect others. And is that what you would like them to do in your direction? That needs to be a more explicit part of our thinking. And you hate to say, and by the way, it's also the best for us, because that kind of breaks down the logic of just doing it for them without any payback to yourself. But in this case, it's clearly the healthiest thing for us to do, and it's the best way to assure U.S. national security through the end of this century, is to manage the rise of China in ways that allows us to implement our shared values. Because the Taoism, the Tao Te Ching, Confucius, the way that they tried to deal with issues of death that our religion struggle with, particularly if you've been studying the Gospel of John, as I have recently with some friends. Oops. That's my warning. That's a warning that I have here every week. I have one to go get the dog, one to go pick up my daughter, one for this and one for that. I think fundamentally we need to recognize the point you made right at the end, that where is the need to dominate East Asia? Shifting to the TPP, I think the legislative fight is whether TPP gets fast-track treatment, whether the administration is allowed to make a deal without having to put out all of the messy details in front of Congress and have it all be debated forever. And of course, China is not currently planned to be part of the TPP. So it's seen by the Chinese as a kind of a way for the U.S. to consolidate its control and its economic relationships around China. Meanwhile, China has also formed trade relationships with ASEAN and Japan and Korea that are opening up more trade there. The Chinese don't necessarily see... We also have a discussion with China now over an investment treaty, bilateral investment treaty, a bit. And the issue there is the Chinese have restricted U.S. investment. And they're saying, no, they only allow us certain things. And we say, don't just tell us what we can do. Make a specific list of what we can't do, and then we'll do everything else. And so we're waiting for the negative list. And we don't want a great big negative list. So the question is, well, how good a bad list is this going to be? You know, how positive is this negative list going to be? And so that's parallel to the TPP. And it's likely not to go... The Chinese say, you know, you restrict trade to us of technologies that are very advanced, whether it's nuclear or airplane guidance and so forth. And we say, yes, they're dual use. You could use them for the military. So we're not going to do that. And the Chinese say, well, that's bogus. We're not going to use them for the military. Well, so there's a high degree of mistrust. And I think... I don't know. There is a strong labor opposition in the United States to TPP. The sense that trade doesn't do us all that good, but except for it does our companies good. And this goes back to the idea that trade shifts around who has work in your economy. Those that have an export capability get more employment, and those that don't lose their jobs. So what are you matching up with your opening of foreign trade? What is matching that in terms of job training? In terms of, yes, minimum wage. That, by the way, minimum wage can be argued that it makes the employer use more capital, make you more productive, or they won't hire you. The Chinese have minimum wages that they rise all the time, and then the employers meet the minimum wage and raise the productivity of their workers. So how do you accommodate those that are cut out or left out? And what are you doing to invest in your economy's understructure that can make more jobs of the type that maybe could be export-related or fill in gaps in your own economy, such as in the healthcare. So I think the TPP, I don't know whether those forces will block fast track or not. My guess is the Republicans and the Democrats both are going to need a lot of campaign contributions in the coming 2 years. So we're going to see fast track the TPP pass. But I'm not optimistic that we'll see matching policies that will make it good for a large number of Americans. And the Chinese probably won't be part of TPP for a long time. Part of it because we're making it pretty tough for somebody to get in TPP, and we're not going to let the Chinese. The Chinese aren't going to meet those standards. Let's put it that way. In terms of Abe and comfort women, I think there is a lot of demonizing of the Japanese. It's a way to gain. These are good stories, war stories. The 70th anniversary of the end of the war in the Pacific will be this summer. It's just happened in Germany, and Germany has acknowledged how bad the Nazi regime was and how bad the German tradition was that brought them that to that point. I heard the Chinese ambassador yesterday tell us that he wonders whether Japan will meet that German standard of criticizing what caused the Second World War on their point of view. And of course, and in particular the comfort women issue, but also the way they treated Chinese in Shanghai, massacre there and rape. And if you've seen Unbroken, the film, or read the book, which I have, you know what their prison camps were like. What were the values that governed Japanese treatment of their prisoners of war and so forth? I think it's going to be hard for the Japanese to acknowledge all of that. It will be easier after this coming election, and Abe has pulled the election forward, so that he's not running for office at the anniversary of the end of the war. And I'm hoping that he will be somewhat more forgiving of the attitudes that the rest of the world has. And somehow we have to also plant a seed that there are many aspects of Japan and its civilization and its culture and its religion that are increasingly dominant, and not to characterize Japan by these stories of abuse that are such good stories. There needs to be some adult commentary about where Japan really is and what its values really have become, and how they have deep roots in Japanese culture and religion and philosophy, and build some bridges of acknowledged sharing of values that I think the current fight undermines pretty severely. Anyway, I didn't probably answer all your questions, George, but...
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? I think we probably have about 7 minutes.
Yes, ma'am.
How do you characterize China's sending delegations to places like Africa, to Cuba now we find out, along with the North Koreans? Is that a way to kind of try to block American influence, or is this part of a kind of plan to continue a global outreach?
Well, that's a good question. It catches a lot of attention that the Chinese are so active in other parts of the world, and particularly in Africa. A friend of mine has done a lot of writing for that at SAIS. There are a number of ways of looking at it, as if it's China trying to undermine our positions around the world, or as it's kind of a feeble way that China's trying to do what we've done for 100 years, and what the Europeans did before us, which is to find ways to get access to resources around the world on terms that benefit ourselves, and they're kind of left with the dregs. I mean, they don't have the same opportunities that we have had to corner allies and friends in the Middle East, which we now have in terms of Saudi Arabia and Jordan. And I think that they're basically making rational decisions about how best to become engaged with the global economy in ways that benefit them. And they also sometimes benefit... in Brazil, the Chinese are the only ones that are coming in with a plan about how to use rail to open up interior Brazil and get it out to ports, and they're putting money into that. It could be an enormous benefit to some interior parts of Brazil. They see, and they also teach how to reduce poverty. They have a center for that, and other countries can send their specialists. And of course, the core of the course is teach them how to be more productive. Teach your poor how to have a higher income. So some of their outreach, I think, is good both for the Chinese, and it may be good for this different system that we all need to evolve, including the United States, about how to treat our poor and how to treat the poor in the rest of the world. Yes, sir.
Interested in your comments on how various cultures need to understand each other's motivations and values, and where the connecting points, rather than simply damning and competing. I've been doing a great deal of work over the last few years on global cities. Cities around the world are in communication with thousands of trips back and forth. A lot of that's on just simple city management issues, but values get discussed in the process. There's a natural collaboration between people at the city level that sort of ignores a lot of the nation state competition. I was last year asked to help with Guangzhou Awards, International Awards for Urban Excellence. The Chinese have decided through the city of Guangzhou that they can be the leading city in the world to stage the annual award competition.
Oh, that's terrific.
What I'm interested in is, do you have any thought as to whether there's a value that can be translated from the city to city? It goes back to, there's no Republican, Fiorello and Guardia, there's no Republican or Democratic way to pick up the garbage bottle. It's very pragmatic. But you also see cities concerned about quality of life. you see a concern about opportunities for people within the cities without having horrific housing at the margin of the cities, like in the slum developments that are coming so fast, how to work on that issue. Is there a way to let any of that collaborative spirit infect what happens at the major state level?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. And from my perspective, I mean, my father and godfather were involved in urban renewal in Baltimore, and also in new projects in the harbor in Boston and other parts of it. And they used to discuss violently what cities should look like and how to make it work. And I remember my urban sociology course at Princeton. For me, I taught at an inner city ghetto school. I taught mathematics during the Vietnam War. The way that cities in the United States are cut up by pre-automobile boundaries, except for places like Los Angeles, has created our own ghettos. And you see them. You see the need for infrastructure spending in cities around the world that could bring together a city more and absorb more of the migrants. I mean, we didn't absorb our migrants from the Deep South very well in the 1950s and 60s. We put them in cities and the money went out to the suburbs, and we still have an underclass as a result. That your question is how the cities are finding solutions that are practical, and they're overcoming some of these issues because they recognize the need for infrastructure. They need to spend on a range of issues that increase jobs, and they need to modernize and move into new sectors like the digital age economies. At the national level, and for me, the core problem at the national level is you have elites that are doing well. They don't want to have a strong democratic government messing in how they make their money. So you need less government is the answer for them. And so the problem is how to break through that kind of thinking. That's less important in cities because the leadership there is more focused on local results. And I at the national level, I have a lot of trouble seeing how the urban experience would break through, but usually it's well-to-do urban leaders that take the lead in renewal or in restructuring of the cities. At least that's in my personal experience. And so I would like to see these urban successes or these urban ideas make the point that those that are privileged at the national level need to take the lead. And it doesn't mean getting a building in a university with your name on it. It means taking the lead in increasing the inheritance tax. My father used to say, raise my taxes. I'd like to see the country do better. But that seems, the idea on Marketplace and NPR is that's stupid. Why would you do that to yourself? So there's a sense of working for the common good that breaks down at the national level. No. Yes, sir, your hand was up first.
We've listened to Jack Ma and Alibaba, and it's a very impressive story. We've got a little problem now with some credibility,
right.
I guess. But anyway, has the success of Alibaba bent the curve with the communists in China, or do we see them tamping him down over time?
Because Alibaba is Chinese Amazon.com, and I think the Chinese are happy to see a national brand as long as he doesn't try to use his influence to change the government. As long as he doesn't say, we need more democracy and the party is not where we need to go. He's not saying that.
That's right.
And so that, I think the borderline here is, do you think that with that thing I stipulated earlier, that in all market economies, some groups do better. And naturally, they turn to change the rules in their direction. I mean, this is really what Marx was all about. And I think we need to change the vocabulary because it's afflicting us in ways. But the answer is not that you have some little group come in and take over. The answer is you build institutions that, on the margin, correct for that tendency. And so I think Alibaba's head is not going to mess with the Chinese sense that, and Deng Xiaoping, he said to President Carter, he said, if we had open elections or third-party elections, this place would blow up like it did in the Cultural Revolution. And so at some, you need some underpinnings, and you need to gradually get where you need to go. And we all need to appreciate how difficult that job is. And I think the head of Alibaba, it sounds to me, has a reasonable sense of what can be done to get you all moving in the right direction. Yes, sir.
Andy. I'm fascinated, having spent 16 months of my life in Korea, that no mention has been made of South Korea in this entire dialogue. And since I know you have to leave for another engagement, could you give us 25 words as to why South Korea has now been relegated to insignificance?
Well, I apologize for not mentioning it. I wrote my PhD dissertation on the Korean economy.
And that was enough.
I lived in Seoul for a year and a half with a Korean family that spoke no English because I wanted to learn Korean. I went to the Myeongdo One Korean Language Institute across Seoul. Worked at the Korean Development Institute, KDI, which if you lived in Seoul, you know a lot about. And so I have a lot of regard for Korea and Koreans. I enjoy speaking Korean with people. It just knocks their socks off. They say, "What?" They're not aware of, you know, anybody that spent that much of his life. So you got all this white hair here. But I don't use it very much anymore. But the Korean economy is a good example of what the Chinese did. The Chinese had a program in the 2000s, still going on, called the Village Investment Project. It's just like the Samhaeulundong, the new village movement in Korea in the early 70s. They replaced thatched roofs with permanent roofs. They improved infrastructure and moved farms around, increased farmland and so forth. So the Chinese have learned a lot from Korea. Korea made the mistake of opening its capital account too soon in the 1970s, late 1980s, early 1990s, and that led to a financial crisis. Its growth rate dropped by about 2 percentage points when that happened and has never really recovered. And so China's growth rates in this stage, and China's now about where Korea was at the end of the 1970s, I think, from my analysis, because I did a lot of research on it for my dissertation, and I lived there. As my father says, you're long enough of tooth to be relevant for history. And so I also seen Taiwan in the late 60s and Japan in 1966. I'm sure George is there much earlier, but you can compare where China is now to eyeball, city to city, rural area to rural area, and China seems to be about where South Korea was. In the late 1970s. And Korea's small. It's about a half the size of a Chinese province. And it's got great access to the oceans, and it's an incredibly hardworking and intelligent population. But the Chinese are doing the same thing. And in fact, my auto repair guy when I lived in Beijing was Korean. But he was Chinese-Korean. There's a huge Korean population in northeast China and in the Beijing area. Great restaurants. You can go get your barley noodles, your cold barley noodles. It's fantastic. So, Sangchusam. Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So I think, you know, China's following Korea's footsteps, but Korea's a little brother.
I think this is about the time.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.